Hello and welcome everyone to ITE1 Module 6 Laptops Part 2 for Semester 1 of 2011. We left off looking at the components of the laptop. Should I just start that section over again on the top view when the lid's open, or would that be helpful to people?
Might as well. We can slice and dice. It'll give people a good last time on Kevy Lecture. They can still remember.
Oh, jeez. Yeah, that's good. Okay. All right, so we're going to look at the laptop open now at the top. So the first thing we have, and I apologize in advance because some of these are quite obvious, but we're going to go through them anyway. Keyboard. The keyboard is a compact input device and has multifunctional keys. Laptops have an additional key known as the function key, abbreviated as the FN key. I like to call it the fun key, just because because I feel like there should be a letter in there. This key allows other keys to perform a different function than usual when the function key is held down. So it creates a lot of fun when you press other keys. The feature that is accessed by pressing and holding the FN key. Yes, very. Yeah, it depends. I was kind of being sarcastic there.
Yeah, fun or another four-letter word with H and L beginning in the end.
Yeah. The feature that is accessed by pressing and holding the FN key is printed on another key in a smaller font or different color, and actually sometimes it's just an icon. There are several functions that can be... A lot of times it's just an icon, and you're expected to be able to determine, and even sighted people can't always determine what this might do, because the icons are kind of cryptic. So
the icon for Bluetooth, for example, looks like, I believe, a blue triangle or a couple of blue triangles, something involving triangles anyway. And so of course when an illiterate person looks at it and they think, oh, what's this blue triangle switch do? Well, then they've lost their...
We actually had a problem. My ex-father-in-law was absolutely useless with icons. And you'd say, what do these keys do when you press the function key? And he would just basically storm off in a huff and go, they've got stupid pictures that nobody knows what they do. Why can't they write on the key what it does? And the picture is supposed to be internationally significant, but it wasn't to him, and it isn't to a lot of people. It's like on the Asus. You've got this picture of this running man, and then you've got this picture of a telephone, and you've got these pictures of all these other things, and we don't know what they do. And then on the actual book, it says press and then press to do this, and then press and then press
they
to
showed
do
the
that.
Picture.
Yeah, so you still don't know. No.
Yeah, I remember cell phones used to read like that, and it was really...
Yes, you are on that
nobody
one.
Nobody could help you find the menus because of the icons, icons and such.
Yep, so this is still fun. Luckily, I'm seeing blind people compiling. I'm seeing people compiling lists of them. The MSI Wind ones are everywhere because I think they were one of the first netbooks that people really took off with. So you can often do a Google if you're not sure what FN F3 does on your, Dell, new awesome PC laptop.
Michael Fair is one of those people. He did one for my Asus, which saved my bacon.
That's good. So some of the different things, there are several functions that can be accessed with this key. Volume settings, display brightness, sleep states, wireless functionality, check battery status, I saw a computer once where FN page up and page down adjusted the volume. The FN key must not be confused with function keys F1 through F12, and as we know, these are located above the numbers on the keyboard, and what they do depends on what operating system and what you're doing at the time when you press them. And of course, we also know too that you can use the Alt, Control, Shift, and various other keys held down to make the F keys do even more things. Going back to the use of the FN key, like we were saying, get a sighted person or the laptop manual if it has descriptions that are helpful so that you can find out which keys do what with the FN key, and write them down. I have that in capital letters. Write them down. Because you will need them and not be able to find them.
The other thing is,
The
and we
in
had an instance of this,
Yep.
I'm not going to dob anyone in specifically, but we had a person, and I'm not going to say who they are, say, "Well, my flatmate said you've got to press this, and then if you don't press this and then press this other thing, then it doesn't do this, but you need to be sighted." Rubbish. Document exactly what the function of the key is and what it does when you press it. If you need to press it 6 times and then followed by 7 presses of the other key, work it out and write it down.
Yeah, and that's a good point. Some of them probably do toggle multiple things. I hadn't even thought about that, but I'm sure they do. So, yeah, but you get sighted help, you write it down, or you record it on an audio recorder or something. That would
The
almost
other
be
thing is,
easier
like
if you've
for
got the
my
sighted
MSI
person
Win,
right there
for
with you.
example, FNF11 is the toggle for the wireless system. The first toggle is everything off, Bluetooth on, wireless on, both on, all off again. So it's actually got 4 states. And you can actually tell by the
Ooh.
way that it goes F24 and zoom and the number of dings that you can tell which state you're in, but you need to know how all that works before you can be happy with that sort of system.
That's cool that on that machine you can actually hear it disconnect and connect the devices, because a lot of times you hit that and the wireless is off and it's done in some other way and you never know. It's nice that they actually did it that way.
And it doesn't even show up in Windows either, which can be
Yep.
very annoying. Oh, and the other thing, of course, is keep it written down on something that is and isn't the computer that you're working on, so that if
That's
one
a
of those
good
keys
point.
you accidentally press is FN F6, like on the Asus, to mute the thing, or F7, and the paper says that it doesn't unmute it, then you have that somewhere else, so you can, research it somewhere else as well.
So if you've got a crusty Braillite 2000 in the cupboard that isn't doing anything, charge those batteries and put those notes on it, because it will come up when your computer
Absolutely.
doesn't.
Or a tape recorder. That tape recorder might be best because then you have the sighted person right there, with you, and say, "Oh no, it's doing this now." Okay. The input devices on a laptop, and we're going to talk about the touchpad, which is a flat pad which consists of right and left click buttons, and a pointer controller.
Sighted people
So
hate them.
these two, which the pointer controller?
No, the touch pads. If you want to make a sighted person stop being grumpy, give them an optical mouse. Your average sighted person, well, theoretically it's no. Get over yourself and learn to use the touch pad because it's on the laptop, and you're not always going to have an optical mouse dragging around. And the day that you're out in some presentation and all the mice have been eaten by the cat, you're not going to be able to use it. Learn to use your touch pad. Fiddle with the acceleration settings. Make it work for you in the first 5 minutes of laptop pain so that you can enjoy the rest of your life. Most people don't even go in and fix the acceleration settings. They just go, "Oh, I hate the touchpad," and drag out the optical mouse.
I would think the
Well,
touchpad
when
might
it's
be easier to use,
No, they're
actually.
annoying.
It depends on you,
Not ha
and it
well, I mean,
depends
if
on
you
your
can.
vision and how mu what your fine motor skills are like. If the acceleration is set properly with the touch pads on the modern laptops, you've got tap to click. You've got things like scrolly areas at the left and right, so you don't even need scroll wheels. And my mum was a classic example. We sort of started her off, and she's like, "Oh, I don't really like this touchpad thing." And then she had to use it because we didn't have the room on the table for the mouse. And I'm like, "There are zones on the edge where it'll scroll." And she's like, "Oh, that's how you do that. Oh, this thing isn't so bad."
I hate the
Okay.
touchpad
because if you're blind and moving around the keyboard a lot and bump the thing, then that just completely throws you off focus.
That is
That's
true.
another instance where if you don't have sighted people, what I do is I set the sensitivity down to God knows how slow, and that way when I brush the touchpad, it doesn't necessarily consider it a mouse movement. Some touchpads, like the Synaptics on my Compaq, actually have a click to a well, I forget what they call it. Type. It's something protect when you type or whatever. But basically, if it notices you're brushing the
Don't
keyboard,
swipe
but
it.
you're also typing. Yeah, it's called something like that. This one's got not quite as cute a name, but the touchpad and the pointer
There's
controller can
also
be
another
used
one.
instead of a mouse for the laptop. Oh, you got another one?
Some of the options for some of the synaptic stuff, yeah, I was just going to say, with the synaptics, you can also make it so that you don't, when the USB mouse is plugged in, the touchpad is disabled. and that's good for sighted people as well. Smart. Also, check your Synaptics and your Alps and your whatever control panels. Not everybody's lucky enough to have the little I just press it and my touchpad goes away. That's an HP thing. Make sure you check whether you've got a little button or a toggle in your software, because a lot of the time when you, and this is a gotcha, because if you install Windows 7, you will get default drivers for the touchpad and you will not get the control software, and you can't turn it off. So when in doubt, make sure you have the drivers for your touchpad, because the control software may allow you to turn it off. Okay, carry on. Sorry. That's my touchpad rant.
Okay. That's actually quite good. I think when they say, because they say the touchpad and the pointer controller are used to control the mouse, and I think when they say pointer controller, they have, some laptops have a little stick or an eraser head. On mine, it was this little bump, and it was kind of rough, and my friend called it the cat's tongue, which I don't know if that's actually, that's probably not what it was actually called, but it did sort of feel like that. On this machine and some of the other ones I've seen, it's been located between the G, the H, and the B, somewhere around there. And what they've actually done is they've got two click buttons at the bottom, so you can use when you have the touchpad. And then they've got two more closer to the space bar that you can use when you're using this little pointy stick thing. I don't know, I had to play with both in NVDA and the BP mouse thing, and they were interesting. Fingerprint reader. The fingerprint reader is an input device used for security authentication, so maybe when you log on. The volume controls are buttons that control audio output. Sometimes they're not actual buttons. Sometimes they're, you know, as we mentioned, FN plus some other key. On some of them, they still have a rotary volume knob. I've seen a few Toshibas that still have a good old knob on them. Power button. Oops, do I really need to describe what the power button does? I don't think so.
The new Toshibas, just be aware of this, is that it is a spinny wheel, but it's not an analog spinny wheel. It's this stupid iSense that I'm spinning it, and it's digital.
Oh, okay. That's a pity. So you can't turn it
while you can't swing it all the way to the left and go, it's turned down. No, we'll turn it all the way to the right and make sure. So it's like those stupid wind-up, wind-down stereos that seem to be so popular in 2011 that have all these stupid digital pretend to be analog controls, and one volume is too low and the next one is too high.
My satellite radio was like that. Yeah, my satellite radio was like
that.
Oh
yeah, you gotta love those.
And the,
with the clicks and the...
Yep.
Well, Dad's
so the power button is...
I think it was back in the 70s. It was interesting. If you pushed the volume buttons on the remote control, apparently the volume knob turned.
Yeah, it has a motor.
Yeah,
they had a motor in there.
It did, uh-huh.
That would, yeah. I've seen one like that. Yes, power button turns the laptop on and off. And on my laptop, it's actually a slide switch, interestingly. On my laptop, the slide switch is the power, and the little round button is the sleep button. I'm not quite sure why they went there. This was an older compact Evo something. All right, so we are going to talk about the laptop keyboard. And the LEDs that are around it, because we've described the keyboard. The wireless LED indicates the activity of the wireless network connection. And similarly, the Bluetooth status LED indicates when the Bluetooth wireless transceiver is enabled. As mentioned earlier, Bluetooth is a wireless industry standard that enables portable devices to communicate over short distances. And that's one that we saw quite a few times as well. The NumLock LED indicates the on or off status of the 10-key number pad, which may be embedded into the laptop. Yes, this is sometimes embedded into the laptop. Some of them actually are big enough that they have a full keypad. But if the laptop is embedded, they're going to use the FN key along with other keys, and you'll need to find out exactly what those are, because those aren't standard. Often JKL are 4, 5, and 6, 7, 8, and 9 are 7, 8, and 9, but it's not standard, and I think Kerry's going to talk about
it. Yeah, I discovered on the MSI Wind U100 and the U90, the number pad does not map the way you think it is, where you press FNJ and you get the number 1, and you can't get at the number pad like you can on, say, the Toshibas and some of the Asuses and stuff. So, if you have the ability to test your laptop in the shop with NVDA Portable before you take it home, Make sure the number pad behaves with the FN key like you expect it to before you buy it, and become very sad with the fact that it doesn't map and you can't actually press the number keys in Reaper. Yeah.
And honestly, we have NVDA Portable now. You can go in and have a test drive of the laptops, and it's such a good idea.
I hadn't even thought about that, but... Or desktops. I'm going to do that if I decide to get one.
Hey, face it, if you've got a Mac, you can press Command F5 and launch VoiceOver. Why should us PC people miss out? We have the technology too.
That's
so go
true.
In and kick the tires.
Yeah.
What's a good way to launch that if it's on a pen drive?
Will has an auto run that you stick the thumb drive in and press enter and it goes da-da-da-dink and you're done.
I usually just figure out what drive letter it is.
That would be
handy. And, sorry about that. I usually figure out what drive letter it is and do and I make sure and extract it to a folder called NVDA. Be careful with the portable version, guys, because it does not have its own directory. So you must extract it to a directory of your choosing. Otherwise, you will end up spewing NVDA all over the root of your drive. So I do /NVDA/NVDA, and it goes, assuming that drive E is the right one. Yeah, question.
Okay, my question because we were talking about this yesterday in exploration. If I were to plug in a thumb drive with a portable version of NVDA, and as Brian Moore said, Windows R NVDA, would it run?
No.
No,
it's not registered as a service. You must have administrative privileges. No, you must have administrative privileges to register a service. If you are not running with administrative privileges, you cannot go Windows R NVDA because the service is not installed.
You can do that though if you've installed it.
Yep.
Yeah, Windows R NVDA.
I hadn't thought to try that.
You should have come to exploration yesterday.
If you install it, it'll do that. But the portable version will not run with that way because there's no service called.
No, it has no way to do it.
It will it will stop talking if you get a UAC dialog because it's not running as a service, so it can't run in elevated command mode.
That's right.
Okay.
That's good.
Well, sorry, it was kind of a stupid question, but
Sort of get and complete silence, and you have to not panic because it can't come up in UAC. The other thing is, we did a whole lot of talking about this, and I'm not going to go into the specifics of it, but essentially, an auto run will not fire off by itself unless it's on media that is considered CD-ROM, so you need to do some messing around with U3 thumb drives if you want it to come up automatically when you plug it in. So Will's solution actually makes it so that it pops up the auto run dialog with the default, and you press enter, and it runs. And I will make that available on the QCAT server, because I know there's 15 of you who want to copy and want to mess with it.
That would be kind of interesting.
Yeah, it would.
Interestingly, I finally looked at NVDA when I had a free minute, and the new version looks really awesome. So, okay.
It is.
Honestly, guys, if you haven't looked at it, you should. Like, don't just make it a free minute. Take half an hour and look at NVDA. You might never use JAWS again. In fact, I know a lot of the people who don't.
Yeah, I know people that use it all the time as their primary.
I'm one of them. And just a plug, we're probably not allowed to do commercial things on here, but you can edit me out. We should send anybody who likes it should send them money so that they don't go away.
Yeah, I agree.
I agree too. We could probably leave that in. We didn't make a huge
Would anybody deal. I'm pretty sure people would be. Would anybody be interested if I can twist his arm, would anybody interested in me dragging one of the developers on for a Cavi chat where we talk about the NVDA review stuff?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I'm pretty sure I'm going to. I'm just gonna ask him again now that he's got his virtual audio cable working, because he got it working and he'll probably come on and talk to us about it.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
I'd like to hear the reasoning behind that was because of the price of regular screen readers, because when they first came out with it, you know, people were asking them why they did it, and that was one of their reasonings. You know, why is it free? And they said because, you know, they wanted to make it where people could access, you know, anybody could access it as long as they had a computer at their disposal.
Yep.
Well, you got to give them one thing. They leveled the playing field. I mean, and you know, it's a fair enough comment. Mac users jump up and down about how amazing VoiceOver is and it's free. That's all very true. But now you've got NVDA in free, so we've got the same thing on the PC, so we all feel equal and happy, and this is a good thing, because we all have an option that isn't Narrator.
That's true. Even if it does have to have Windows installed, at least it can be used.
I'm working on kicking it up from the pre-execution environment. Watch this space.
Oh, cool. Yeah, that would be great. See, that's what I thought they should implement.
You mean like
too.
Making it an MSI?
We don't know. We're going to see what the possibilities are. But we think we should be able to get it up before the out-of-box experience. I believe we can fit it in as a post-run thing, but we've got to work on that. It could be an interesting project.
Yeah.
Okie dokie. Well, if we are going to have an NVDA Thursday or Thursday, Friday, whenever chat, then that'll be awesome. So let's go back to what we're doing now. The caps lock LED tells us when caps lock is on or off.
Handy hint, light
and
probe for the
eye keys
thing.
Will give us this. Yes, that's true. Although finding a small LED like that might be a little tough.
I did it.
He can do his caps lock key. It's not
easy.
Okay. Yeah, they probably try and make that fairly apparent, I think.
Basically, you wave the thing and it goes. And you know that's the caps
lock
key.
Yeah, I have it. I'm just trying to figure out. Okay.
The advantage to the commercial light probes that are not that I'm knocking the eye thing because I haven't actually tried light probe yet, but the one good thing about the other ones is the actual light detector, the hardware ones are about the size of a pencil, so it's a lot easier to tell where the barrel of the thing is pointing and a little bit more accurate. But I mean, it's nothing against getting
they're hard
the,
to find.
What is it, $6 or $2 app or something as opposed
99
to
cents.
Unit? Yeah, okay,
99
okay,
cents.
Cool.
Yeah, I'd go get it. Like if you've got any iTunes credit light detector, you should have it if you've got an eye thing, because it just is cool, even so you can turn all the lights off in your house.
And then if you want to assault your eardrums, put it in front of a bare light bulb and turn it on and watch it go crazy. Because I immediately decided, hey, let's try that. There's a bunch of bare light bulbs around this mirror. It was quite awesome.
That's probably a point. The fact that it uses a square wave means that it's going to be louder than Karen or Samantha by a great big margin.
Oh,
so
it's loud. Yeah, it's loud.
And, as my roommate who's musically inclined says, you could do some wicked guitar solos with that.
My dad was doing that, sadly. Okay, the hard drive activity light, which is not the thinking light, as Carrie pointed out several weeks ago. The hard drive activity light LED actually indicates the activity of the hard drive, so it tells you when the hard drive's going. That does not tell you when the computer is doing stuff, because obviously it can still do stuff without spinning the hard drive. And the power on LED is an on-off status, indicates the on-off status of the laptop. That's pretty straightforward. Battery status LED, and this indicates the condition of the laptop battery. I'm not exactly sure how that would work. Probably just tell you whether it's charged well or not, I'm guessing. Hibernate/standby light. The hibernate or standby LED indicates whether the computer is in standby mode or if it is entering or leaving hibernate mode. I'm sorry, I'm having trouble reading today. On many laptops, a small pin on the laptop cover contacts a switch when the case is closed, called a LCD cutoff switch. The LCD cutoff switch tells the CPU to conserve power by extinguishing the backlight and turning off the LCD. If this switch breaks or is dirty, the LCD remains dark while the laptop is open. Carefully clean this switch to restore normal operation. I think some of us wouldn't mind if the LCD
or
continued
a blind
to stay
person
dark,
tapes
but
down.
Well,
yeah, that
yeah,
can happen as well.
Help.
The other thing that Mr. Will Taylor does is he actually disassembles the LCD, which I do not recommend to anybody here, and removes the cold cathode. That stops it from lighting up too. And you get an extra hour's worth of battery.
Yeah, that would do it.
Man, that would almost be worth it.
It was. Obviously, don't do it if you're ever going to have sighted people use your laptop, and you may want to get somebody
Absolutely.
A bit more tech-savvy to actually disassemble the panel. They're not an easy thing to take apart. But yes, there is a little cable that you can disconnect off the cold cathode, and then the screen doesn't light up, and you get more battery.
Okay, now we're going to talk about base stations and docking stations, and I think we're going to actually do that lab today. Am I correct? We're going to actually try and get this lab today. Someone did send it in, and I'll still grade that. That's perfectly okay. Trying to go into my documents, and I got the Dell Solution Center, so we'll get that out of the way. I'm going to pull this up while I've got it here. So we're going to go over it together down, in just a second.
I'll go into the grade book now, and I will mark down who is...
That would be great if you could do that. I was thinking of asking you to do that, and that would be very helpful. Let's pull up my copy here. Okay, this is... Alright, so a base station is a device that attaches to AC power and to desktop peripherals. This gives you access to power and more peripherals than are included on your laptop itself. There are two types of base stations. A base station is a general large term, and then under those, so the two types of base stations are the docking station, which have more ports, drive bays, speakers in some cases, and PCI slots. There's also a port replicator, and this is smaller and basically gives you access to more ports such as USB, network, parallel VGA, and FireWire, but it doesn't have the things like the PCI slots and the speakers and that kind of thing. It's a little bit smaller. It sort of makes extra ports hang off of the laptop, is my understanding. I've actually only ever seen a docking station. Base stations can be connected via specialized connectors, USB, FireWire, or through card slots. And you have a lab about these, and we're going to go ahead and... you have one, which asks true or false questions, so let me get to... let's continue reading about these for just a moment. Many of these components on the docking station are the same as, or almost identical to, the ones on the laptop. Therefore, we'll try not to waste time explaining them again. We're just going to explain the ones that are different and tell you which ones are identical and still here, but we don't need to go through them again. The docking station gives you more of these ports that are going to be easier to access. So they have additional ports or ports you do not have on the laptop, and they might also have things that would be covered up by actually putting the docking station on.
Just a note, guys, if you want to line in on your laptop, you might want the docking station. Many docking stations have line-ins on them, and that makes blind people very happy.
That's good to know, actually. What I can't remember is how far through this I go before we actually start answering the questions. I don't remember what actually is quite on here.
You go through the whole docking station and port replicator
the
stuff.
The whole docking station section. Okay. All right, so we're not quite done yet.
Interestingly, just as a bit of a side note, the laptop I saw I worked with today with my student, it actually had a line-in jack, but and right beside all the three jacks was an infrared port. And it's the most easy to find infrared port on the laptop that I've ever seen. I wish my laptop was like that. Just thought of it as a side note, thinking of line-in.
Mine was right on the front, and you could find it real easy, too. Okay, so here are some of the things on your docking station. So this docking station is an example, just as the laptop was, so yours is going to be different, or the one you're looking at. On the top of this docking station, we have the power button, and this is a power button so that you can turn the laptop on and off while the laptop is actually in the docking station. Probably because it's bigger, it's just easier to get to. The eject button is used to... It's a lever that will release the laptop from the docking station so that the laptop can be removed. Some laptops have a feature where you can undock the computer by using a button or an icon, which you may want to do instead before ejecting the laptop. I imagine that also has the effect of safely removing some of the peripherals that the laptop has provided you while it's been in the docking station. The only computer I've seen that had a docking station, there was a button in this XP start menu right near shutdown that said toolbar undock computer button, and you pressed it and then you could take the laptop out of the docking station. Docking connector. The docking connector is a socket that is used to attach a laptop to a docking station. And some of these, like we said, are proprietary, and they'll be oftentimes on the bottom. On the back of this particular docking station, we have the exhaust vent, which is an outlet that expels hot air from the interior of the docking station. They might need ventilation, just as the laptops do. The AC power connector is a socket that is used to control the AC power to connect the AC power adapter to the docking station. Usually they would probably use the same AC adapter, but not necessarily. I guess they could potentially have separate ones, but that wouldn't make a whole lot of sense. PC card or express card slot. And actually, while I'm mentioning the word express card, let me mention that the word is express and card, the two words put together, but the first letter of each word is capitalized. Just because it took me a while to realize this, and until I actually started reading it in my Braille display, I didn't realize. Anyway,
One
the
other point about
express
docking
card.
stations. When
Yep.
we got a docking station for our Tekra. Very quick interjection. Reaper demo tomorrow if anybody's interested. So let me know by the end of lecture if anybody wants to show up. We realize it's Thursday night before Easter, but we're going to do a more structured one, so think about that. We had a docking station
Fine
for
with
the
me.
Tekra, and we had you actually got an extra adapter, AC adapter with the docking station, as well as the one that came with the laptop, so you could
Oh.
leave one in the bag and one with the docking station. And the docking station was like
Oh.
$150, and usually you'd pay $120 for the adapter, so it was a really good idea to buy the docking station because the adapter came with it. Very cool.
Yeah, that is kind of cool with it. And that makes a lot of sense, actually, too. As long as they're absolutely identical and you can't,
They
mix
were.
them up,
They
that's
were
a great
the same
idea.
part number, model, blah, blah, blah. I even scanned the UPCs and they were the same
Awesome.
UPC.
That's awesome. So if you have a laptop that has docking station, it might just be a good idea to get one of these. PC card or express card slots. This works the same as on the laptop. It just provides easier access to the slot when the laptop is docked, so you have the was it PC card slots at the top and express cards at the bottom? I might have that wrong, so I'll let me just. Oh, it says express cards are on the top and PC cards are on the bottom. Okay, the VGA port. This is the same as on a laptop. You can connect your VGA monitor. This docking station also has a DVI port, which is a socket that is used to attach a digital video monitor. This was not included on the laptop itself, so that's why they've put it here. They're kind of funny looking. They've got screw holes just like the VGAs, but the pins are sort of offset and are actually on the cable, and they're kind of pokey and weird. I can't really describe them really well, except to say that they're fairly unique, I think. Line-in connector, as Gary was talking about. This is a socket that's used to attach an audio source. Tape players are good ones to put on the line-in, for example. The headphone connectors, they put one on the docking station as well, and it does the same thing. USB ports, they just give you more of them, or they may provide better access to them while the laptop's in the docking station, but they do the same thing. They have an external mouse PS2 port for attaching a mouse, and they also have one on the back for the PS2 keyboard. These are not interchangeable, as we've talked about before, so the correct device must go into the correct port. You may need to get some assistance or just be very careful, and you'll eventually learn that about your docking station if it is actually yours. External diskette drive connector. This is unique to the docking station in this example. The external diskette drive connector is a socket that is used to connect an external drive. I'm imagining that since they're calling it that, maybe that's where a floppy drive might attach to. I'm not quite sure. That's the connotation I'm getting. The parallel port is the same thing as it is on the laptop, connecting parallel devices, old printers, scanners, things like that. Serial ports, they're a socket that is used to connect a device such as a mouse or trackball. That's a bit dated to me. I think most of the time the mice and trackballs are going to connect via USB or PS2, so this serial port is going to probably be for more industrial equipment or devices such as note takers, old Braille displays, or switches for some of the switches for the disabled physically. Adaptive switches will plug in through serial, but you're not really seeing serial mice and trackballs anymore. Modem port, that's the same as on the laptop. They've got one on your docking station. They've also got an Ethernet port here. The right side of this docking station includes the following. We have a key lock, and this is the same type of thing as on the laptop. The picture indicates that this locks the laptop into the docking station, and I'd also imagine that it might allow you to lock the docking station to something else. Okay, so we are now done with the description of the laptops, or the docking station. So we're going to go ahead and move on to the true false now. So go into your chat windows. Let me make sure I'm in my chat window. That would probably be a good idea. And I'm going to minimize my Ventrilo window to keep from going insane here, so it doesn't say Ventrilo dot dot dot. I'm still here, right, guys?
You are.
Yeah, you're still
okay.
Here.
All right, good.
So are we.
Okay.
Wake
that's
up, everybody.
Good.
It's time for
I apologize for the. I apologize for the.
Is there a question?
Do we actually fill in the lab as well?
No.
Nope.
If you participate,
nope. We just talk
and type
about
in
it.
True. If you type in true and false in the chat window, you're going to get points for it. If you are not here and you're not participating, though, I'm looking at the window now, so I'll be able to tell who is typing in and who isn't.
That's good. Okay, so these are true or false questions. Hang on. How is this laid out here? Oh, I see how they've done this. Okay. All right, here's the first one. Yeah, So the first one says, docking stations are usually smaller than port replicators and do not have speakers or PCI slots. Is that true or false? Yeah, that is false. So we need true or false, and F&T is fine. Yes, that is a false statement. How about this? The exhaust vent is an outlet through which the fan expels hot air from the interior of the docking station. That's correct. It does expel hot air, so that is a true question. Okay, how about this one? A laptop can be secured to a docking station with a key lock. Is that true or false? That is true. You can't actually secure your laptop to your docking station with a key lock. I really hope my jaws isn't bleeding through, because that would be really bad.
No, not at all.
I suspect it isn't.
Nope, it's not.
Okay, that's good. All right. The RJ11 modem port connects a laptop to a cabled local area network. Is that true or false? Yeah, that's false. Why?
That's the other cable. It's the other cable. It's just the opposite.
Yeah, RJ11 is for phones. So the next question says... Yes, RJ45 is for the Ethernet. Very good. And that was actually the next question. This says, the Ethernet port uses an RJ45 socket to connect a laptop to a standard telephone line. Is that true or false?
It could,
does it?
But 48 volts will definitely do nasty things to your laptop, so don't.
Ouch. Yeah, that would fit, wouldn't it? It would.
Sort of.
You think the Ethernet would carry more signal than the phone line, though, especially with more wires.
It does.
No, they're actually compatible. In fact, there are actually RJ12s that fit into RJ45s. You get, like, the combo jacks, and it is actually possible to do.
Their answer is no, you don't want to do that.
Yeah, their answer is no, and you probably don't.
You don't. I've accidentally almost done it, because I jammed a cable where it wasn't supposed to go, and then had fun trying to fish it out because I realized that I had really messed it up. But okay, so to review, your RJ11 is your cable that's going to go to a 56kbps modem. Your RJ45 is your network Ethernet cable. That goes in to your DSL. It goes between your routers and your computers. So RJ11, you can usually associate with a phone line. RJ45, you can usually associate with a router or network cable.
I actually have an old serial cable adapter for a device that is the cord is actually looks like a phone, a phone jack.
Probably the DeckTalk Express, I'd imagine. That's kind of what they did. Probably a DeckTalk Express.
Just to be technical, yes, you can connect RJ45s to serial. Basically, it wires pins 1 through 8, so you miss out on ring detect. So if you use one of these adapters and you're actually relying on ring detect to turn up on a modem to know when to answer the phone, it ain't going to work. But there you go.
Okay. This one says that Let's say it says the DVI port is a 15-pin socket that allows port that allows output to external displays and projectors. Is this true or false? That is false, and it threw me for a second because that's actually not the DVI is not 15 pins, and I almost said, "Well, wait a minute, it does the same, it does the right thing, but it's not the right number of pins." So
the VGA.
The 15 pin version is a VGA. Yes.
Does anybody know?
Sometimes 20. Sometimes
24 to 29.
Four, I believe.
Yay.
It's confusing.
24 to 29 is probably right. They used to actually have that question on your tests, and it was the only visual cable looking question you got. So everybody who got that wrong, I would always make them look it up because it helped them to know that in the end. Of
really
course, that
the
is
only
now
way
gone.
You could know.
I wish I'd have had that on the test. I might have got a better score.
No, it's a final question.
No, it was an old, yeah.
Or it used to be.
Well, it was a final question, probably. Let's see, where are we? The line-in connector is a socket used to attach an audio source. I did too. Yep, that's true. We all know what our line-in is, because people usually like audio things. So you're right. The eject button releases the peripherals from the docking station. Is that true or false? Yes, what does it actually do?
Release the laptop.
The laptop.
Yeah, the laptop itself.
Yeah. And the funny the funny thing is that half of the class gets it wrong every year. No, it does. How did I get that wrong? Read the question very carefully again.
Very carefully.
Kind of kick yourself.
You have to make sure it's ejecting the right thing. Yes, we know it's an eject button. It's going to eject
it's
something.
The difference between peripherals
what
and
is
laptop,
it?
Yeah.
So this yep. is one of your first exercises in language and usage of computer language, and you get a few more here. And this is also going to help you on your test. You want
also,
to make sure.
I was going to say, if you have a Braille display, use it for the test, because maybe if you read Braille, it's going to make more sense under your fingertips. Drag out those serial cables and hook up that Braille note that you never hooked up to JAWS before, because it will make your life easier. Continue.
What I was going to say is
pull out your power
important.
Braille or your power Windows / Combi Braille.
I've got one.
I know.
So
and it works.
I have a team in a Combi Braille 85. I never could make the synthesizer work, but it works nice as a Braille display.
There's a special cable for that, and I'm not going to talk to you about it on lecture, but yes, it can be made to go, and I know people who know how, but that's not relevant here.
Ooh, I want to record. Okay. Anyway, we got one more.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't know we weren't done.
You weren't done yet.
No, you were going to talk about something.
We've got one more.
Yeah, okay. You go ahead and do yours.
Yeah, we got one more question. The parallel port is a socket that is used to connect a device such as a printer or a scanner. Is that true or false? Yeah, that's true. Good job, guys. That's the last
awesome
one
job,
on
guys.
Here.
So, fantastic. As I was going to say, this is your first, foray into the language bits of this course. And it's very important to make sure you are calling the proper cable or component the proper name. Because, as you can see, RJ45 and RJ11 are quite easily mixed up. And different cables are often mixed up in what they do. So you want to know, what does it do? How does it connect to something? How many pins is its connector?
What does it look like?
And what does it look like?
I've got a question.
Yep.
Sure. Go ahead.
Isn't it true that, at least I thought I had read someplace that an RJ11, you know, your telephone cable, could be used as a network for your household network?
Yes, you can. It's actually called PNA or something. It's like it's a bit similar to the home plug standard, but it actually works over phone lines. And it's one of those horrific things that may or may not work. And if you happen to have too much money and two phone sockets on the same loop and you plug it in and it works, you'll be a happy person. But then you'll go out and spend more money on the Ethernet over power line standard because it's faster and works better anyway. But yes, it's called PNA, home networking. And yes, you can use the phone system as a low speed network. And I will underline the
probably
word low
speed.
You're looking at like 10 megabits.
Sure
a second, or you may even get 100, but it's not going to be gigabit over your phone line, let me assure you.
No.
Yeah, I mean, I thought when I first looked at network stuff, and I mean, I gave up on it because it kind of broke, and that's probably why I didn't try it over the phone thing. But I remember seeing it on there, and that question kind of threw me at first when it talked about the RG11 hooking up to a cable, whatever it was on that question. But it kind of threw me at first, but then I figured that...
cable Ethernet, yeah.
The logical answer, I guess. So yeah.
The Cisco curriculum doesn't ever mention it in any of their curriculums, basically. So
nope, they never
doesn't
have,
exist.
As far as I know.
Yeah, this is something that I kind of read in my the help menus of Windows when I was looking up, when I first started looking up networking, you know, to hook up a network at home. So yeah, it's cool.
A little before we move completely off of RJ, I've always meant to look it up, but I discovered at a fairly, well, not a fairly young age, but I discovered that if you were careful, you could take the receivers of some phones, take the connector, which was slightly smaller than the RJ11 that goes into your wall, put it in just the right way, and hear conversations on the phone and not be heard. And that was quite cool, actually.
The other The other thing you could also do if you had them was to get a little induction pickup and lie it near the phone cable and then amplify it up so you didn't even take anything off hook. That's the other way of doing it, and then you can record it.
Oh, wow, that would have been great.
There's also a little alarm phone that I have that had at one point that where if the alarm was turned on, it sort of acted as a speakerphone with no mic, and the people's voices came out of the speaker. It actually got annoying when I was reading and hearing people's conversations in the other room.
Jeez, you guys ought to be hired by Homeland Security, I guess.
Pretty much.
There was this phone for kids that was the clueless phone, and when someone picked up, it would go, "Someone is listening," because it would detect the voltage that happens when a phone gets picked up. It was for little girls, and I remember hearing about it. And at the time, I didn't know how it worked. Yeah, someone is listening. That's funny.
I'm dating myself, but I remember the old phones with the condenser mics. If you unscrewed the microphone bit, it wasn't actually wired on. It was just held by a magnet, and you could unscrew the microphone and take it out and lift up the receiver and listen to conversations without your mic working.
I remember those days.
What was that?
An iPod alarm.
I'm sure it was. Okay. Now we're going to talk about laptop components on the inside. The components in laptops are different to the ones in desktops. Desktops are standardized, while laptops have proprietary parts. This is because each manufacturer handles the challenge of making laptops small and efficient in different ways, even from model to model of the same company's machines, I have found. they all need to cut corners to make it work. Not necessarily in a bad way, but they all need to do their own little tricks to get it to fly. Laptops use small outline memory modules called SODIMMs, S-O-D-I-M-M, apostrophe S, well, this case has an apostrophe S, small outline dual inline memory module.
That's a grammar error, because like the desktop. SODIMM doesn't own the S.
That's true. That may just be something here. So these look like regular desktop RAM, but hit with a shrink ray. That was Grace's wording, not mine. But I liked it, so I kept it. I imagine they do, actually. Laptop CPUs are lower profile and usually do not have to have a heat sink, so they're different as well. They are designed to be small, use less power, and put out less heat. This makes sense if you think about what a laptop is trying to allow you to do. CPUs in laptops can be throttled to produce even less heat and to conserve power. This happens on battery and also depends on what type of activity you are doing at the time. And on some laptops, this is very noticeable. It's especially noticeable, I find, for those of us using a screen reader, because it can sometimes decrease the snappiness and stuff, at least on the laptop I have. Now we're going to talk about the wonderful world of power management. Desktops are designed to be set up and used in one place. Power is sent from the wall to the computer's power supply, and then out to all the components. Because laptops can use batteries, hey guys, you knew that, right? And are designed to be mobile, they need more optimized power management to conserve the battery. Laptops can only run on direct current or DC power. The power that comes from the wall is AC current. Laptops come with an AC adapter which converts the AC current into the DC current which the laptop likes and at the voltage the laptop requires. When the AC adapter is connected, laptop power management detects it, provides power to the laptop's components, and charges its battery. When the AC adapter is unplugged, the power management uses the laptop's battery. So in the desktop power supply, that AC to DC conversion is handled by the power supply, but the laptop's the AC adapter does that because the laptop's we don't want a big power supply in our laptops. Advanced power APM or advanced power management was an earlier form of power management that controlled power management functions through the BIOS. ACPI, Advanced Configuration and Power Interface, is the modern standard for power management, which allows you to control power settings from the operating system, and thank goodness, because it means that it's easier for people to do. This is what lets you use power options in Windows or whatever operating system you're using. If you haven't, everybody should take a look at this dialog box on your computer to learn how it works and what options are particular to your machine. So if you haven't, you should probably do that because it will make some of the it will put some of this into better context for you.
You can customize devices. It too, so.
Oh yeah, you can. Yeah, we'll talk about that. But
if the
good thing to know how to play with. Yeah, in this chapter we focus on the Windows standard power management. Some companies, Toshiba has had in the past, maybe still does, their own little power management control panel-y thing that lets you do even more stuff, which may or may not be accessible to screen readers. But for the focus of this chapter, we're going to talk about what Windows allows you to do.
Power utility. PowerCFG.exe allows you to tweak all sorts of things from the command line, including turning on and off Hibernate. Go look it up on the knowledge base if you get bored. It is so very powerful.
Ah. Yeah, you could combine
works
that
all
with
the way from XP through
keys
to 7.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. You can go, no, I want the monitor standby after 30 minutes.
That's kind of cool. Okay.
You know, we don't teach people how to make shortcuts in this course at all, which is ironic.
No, we don't actually. And put hotkeys to them. If you want to know how to create shortcuts and put hotkeys to them, have a chat with one of us and we'll walk you through it. I think quite a few people do, but and this is important when you're installing certain screen readers because it wouldn't take that long.
It can. We can do all sorts of things like send to lame and all sorts of things, and we can do all sorts of little power things. We could. Yeah.
Good. Okay.
Hotkey saved me when JAWS crashed today and I loaded NVDA to figure out what was happening. So
I've actually told people, and I've told quite a few people this, even if you don't want to use NVDA, don't think you will ever use it, download a copy, install it, and have it around for emergencies. Even if you've never opened it for any other reason, although
now
you
one
should
because
it's really cool, like we
one
were talking
other point.
About.
If you don't want to use NVDA, remember it can use any sappy voice on your system, okay? So put it on, and if necessary,
welcome
flick
to
it
NVDA.
To Paul. You know, set it to Paul, Karen, Kate, whatever person you can drag in that will make your machine run like a dog but sound beautiful to your ears, and it will be there when you press the buttons.
And the good thing about putting that Alt-Control-N in shortcut is invariably jobs, which might take from 1 or 2 to 5 to 10 seconds to load to more. NVDA is about 1 to 3. So,
and if you want to make it faster,
depends
Hayden,
on the system. I've seen it take a little bit more than that. But
you can actually put a command line option. If you do an NVDA /?? At the command prompt, I think it's /M or /N that bypasses playing the startup chime, and that makes it come up even faster.
Wow.
I like the startup chime because it actually confirms to me that it is in fact loading.
That's mine just goes.
You can actually replace those. That little
piano music. Yeah, you just press it and it goes, mine, you just press the Control Alt N and this voice goes, taskbar! And it's like, yeah, you're there.
You can actually change those sounds. You could make them something shorter and smaller if you chose to. I know somebody who did that. Okay. Expansion devices or peripherals increase the functionality of both desktops and laptop computers. Yeah. Can you guys name some expansion devices? What kind of peripherals can we add to expand these guys? Hello, wakey.
Anybody awake?
Yes, external desktops, printers, scanners, yes.
Printers.
Yes, wireless cards.
Yeah, wireless cards, good. PC
I've
cards,
got an old
yes.
Cisco or USB dongles. I've got a Cisco 350 that works in Braille notes, which is very rare indeed.
Wow! That's cool.
USB hot plates.
Yeah.
I suppose you... Braille,
come on, USB
Braille
fridge,
toys,
the think? USB desk fan. I mean, let's get USB anything, okay? Including missile launchers, okay? So that's USB covered.
Yeah, and light up Christmas trees. And ThinkGeek has a lot of those. Okay, so yes, we
fridge,
can
cool.
use. Yeah, that would probably be better on a desktop, though.
We've just had a question. Do the USB fridges really work? Yes, but only down to 18 degrees centigrade, which isn't that cool, but it's good on a
nah.
hot day when your kangaroos are sweating in the midday sun. 18 degrees is good.
And they have cup warmer/coolers, too, so you can keep your coffee hot or whatever. Just be careful with it.
Let's
so
just
yes,
keep
in
mind that
using...
5 volts at 2 amps is 10 watts. Just think of what 10 watts can do and be a bit realistic.
Yeah, that's true. It's in addition to using USB and FireWire devices, and I actually need to fix this because FireWire wasn't written right here. On modern computers and parallel and serial ports on older ones, laptops can also use PC card slots, which we've mentioned a couple times. Desktops have more room to expand inside the case, so you can put the PCI or PCI Express cards in the desktop because it's bigger. Laptops don't have that room, so they use the hot swappable peripherals that are plugged into the outside of the case. So can someone define hot swappable for us?
Something you can take in and out without buggering up your system.
Absolutely, yes. They're designed to be...
like that.
Yep. They are designed to be removed and inserted with the computer still on. You don't have to...
Careful.
...turn it off.
Read the book, because sometimes those CD-ROMs that look hot-swappable aren't. For example, a lot of the Dell peripherals that go into the bizarro Dell Expandy Bay TM, patent pending, are not hot-swappable.
Yeah, you should, and a lot of, even though it's hot swappable, you still should use safely remove hardware on most of these guys. Devices can be swapped safely while the computer is powered on, as long as they are removed safely. That's the answer.
I was going to say, I guess hot swappable means plug and play, rip out and pray.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
That's a good way of defining it.
There we go.
Now, I read a message, speaking of a safely eject remove, I read a message on this the other day on the Microsoft Knowledge Base of all places. Basically, you can go through every USB device you've got and set the policy for quick removal. And it is then safer to reef it out of the slot before walking away. However, it is still highly recommended that you safely eject. And if you lose stuff because you ripped it out because those 6 copies of Word you had open weren't closed and you've got temp files scattered all over your hard drive, or USB thingy, then that's your problem. So please do not avoid using safely remove. Windows B, get to the taskbar, find safely remove, DAC the spacebar, and do it. That's how you do it with NVDA. Do it in your usual JAWS way if you want, although Windows B getting to the taskbar is often more reliable. Under Windows,
now,
you can
do something else.
Actually, yeah. We're just going to say something.
Sorry,
about
Brad.
That because if
I was just going to say, am I the only one that's done the safely remove thing? And, you know, it says safe to remove the, you know, device. You pull it out, and it still goes dong-dong like it's...
No, that's Windows like 7. It does that.
Windows XP occasionally will do it. This is XP, though.
I'm using XP, and it still does that. And I don't... Every once in a while, it'll
do
that. And it
The reason it does it is because it goes didding if there's still power to the USB, and for some reason if the USB subsystem hasn't shut the power down to the device, and maybe it's just a glitch, it will still make the remove sound, and that's okay.
Yeah, some drives
might still wondering about that.
Take power, yeah. Windows 7 will do that regardless. One of the things that I've started doing, and I've had to really exercise my patience at work, but when my flash drive, when I've closed everything and my flash drive still cannot be removed for time or money by the safely remove hardware, I've resigned myself to the fact that, you know what, to be safe, I'm going to have to shut the computer down, wait for it to turn off, and then pull my drive out. It took me a while to to be like, okay, I'm going to have to do this to be safe. But really, because there are times when it just will not, you know, and you wait 5 minutes and it just will not let you take the drive out safely. And so you're like, just shut the computer down and do it. That way there's no chance you've lost information that way.
There is actually a utility, and I'll go and rat it up. I think it's in the Power Toys. The sys internal stuff that will actually tell you what files are open on a particular volume. And you can point that at a thumb drive and it'll tell you what's open.
I think the Mac now tries to do that. At least tell you which application is preventing your drive from ejecting. And it'd be good if Windows could do that too.
The big one is virus scanners that have those silly on-access scans and stuff
That
decide
true.
They're keeping things open.
I hadn't thought about that. Okay, we're going to have a quick review of different ways to store data. Does somebody want to give me an example of a magnetic storage device?
Hard drive?
Yep, hard drive is one.
Cassette tape, just kidding.
No, actually, they are magnetic storage. In the old days, that's how you did it. Floppies, good.
I actually had a storage device, just to digress very briefly. It was called a videotape backup unit, and you plug two RCAs into your video recorder, and you could store 150 megabytes on a videotape. It was amazing.
Wow.
For, like, 1990.
Wow.
Oh, man.
Yeah, so tape drives, zip disks, I don't know about jazz drives, but certainly zip disks. Remember those 100 megabyte days?
Well, the other thing is that the audio track wasn't used, so you could put your favorite music on, and that way you could run the videotape to the right point, and you'd know where the song started, so you'd know what was stored at the different places. Okay, I'm done now.
Oh, my God. Oh, wow.
That is way too cool.
That's good. That's geeky.
Oh, yeah. Okay, about a
interesting case in point. You know those
storage
super
device.
Floppies? Do you remember those super floppies that nobody really uses anymore?
Yeah, they were actually the 120 meg, yeah.
Yeah, I've actually got five of the drives sitting at home in a box. That's neither here nor there. That was actually laser-guided magnetic, so that was an interesting sort of hybrid.
Oh, yeah. I remember the Braille Note had a super disk drive. It didn't work very well, but that was just the drive itself. What about a flash-based storage device? Examples of those?
Like a compact flash card.
Yeah, very good.
The USB sound
we'll
card that I'm talking to you on through the headset that acts as the sound card. It's probably got some flash memory in it somewhere.
No. We're talking about storage, though. We're talking about storage.
There is no memory in that, actually, Aiden. It actually maps a window into system memory. It doesn't actually have memory on the flash-based thing, but that's okay.
Oh, okay. That's why I mentioned it.
There are some combination flash drive and USB cards, or sound cards, that are out there. Not very many of them. Well, the Olympus recorders, the DM520 and DS line, can do that. Very good, guys.
Yeah,
and you have solid state hard drives
as
well.
You have one of them too.
Oh, really? Okay, that's cool.
Maybe you can even have Bluetooth storage with that. That is really cool.
I don't know if they go that far.
No, but they have a 2 gig flash drive in them for, in theory, loading keeping their software on, so you can load it onto PCs when you carry it around.
You can put NVDA on there.
That works. I've done it.
Does NVDA work with that display, too? I think it does, doesn't it?
It does, yeah.
Nice. Okay. Cool. And optical media, we have examples of that, guys?
Blu-ray, DVD, CD.
Audio CD.
Yep, now be careful. The media would be the DVD, not the DVD drive. So be careful there. We're talking about the actual stuff it gets stored on right now. Someone did in chat. I don't know exactly who, but I had seen DVD drive and CD burner come across, and that's the drive itself. But the media.
We know who did
well
it. We're not going to dob them in, okay? But yes.
No, I wasn't going to.
Yeah, that's fine. I'm saying we know who it is. We've sorted that out.
Okay, so now let's talk about how these different things work. Magnetic hard drives have drive motors designed to spin magnetic platters and the drive heads. Look at the hardware discussion files and you can see these guys actually take a hard drive apart. It's quite cool. Flash memory requires no power to maintain data and has no moving parts. Solid-state drives use flash memory. Cisco likes these. These drives provide faster access to data, higher reliability, and less power consumption. They are also more expensive, considerably more expensive at this point. We're also going to review really quickly three types of optical media.
Just one thing I was going to say. We just had a comment here that goes, they don't have many gig on them, do they? Yes, I've seen 512 gig solid-state drives. They'll be $1,000 a throw. Yeah, $1,000 a throw. The other thing you've got to keep in mind, guys, though, is if you've got like a little netbook or something and you put in like a 64 gig or 32 gig solid state drive, maybe that's all you need for your operating system and working documents. Try plugging in an external if you want gobs of storage and stick other things on there. Okay, off we go.
All right. CDs, the one we're most familiar with, have a data storage capacity of approximately 700 megabytes. Or audio storage of 80 minutes. The older ones were 650 megabytes of data and 74 minutes, respectively. DVDs have a data storage capacity of approximately 8.5 gigabytes on one side of a disk. I thought it was 4.5.
No, DVD plus 5 is 4.7, which is 4,700,000,000 bytes, or 4,489 megabytes of 2 to the power of 10. You did ask. CDs, if you want to know why it is 74 minutes of audio and it is 650 meg of storage, that is because the audio is stored in sectors of 2,352 bytes with less Solomon error correction than the data sectors of 2,048 bytes. Okay, I'm done.
Hang on, but where I'm confused, where I'm seeing here that DVDs have a storage of 8.5,
bought ones.
Should be 4.5,
the bought ones.
No, oh, the bought ones,
no.
Too.
The bought ones that are burnt, the DVD ones that have got your movies, single-sided movies, are 8.5 gigs. They don't say DVD rewritable has a storage. They say DVDs have a storage.
Okay, yeah, that may be coming up. Okay, all right. BDs have a storage capacity of 25 gigabytes on a single-layer disk and 50 gigabytes on a dual-layer disk.
Anyone here got a Blu-ray burner? I don't have one.
Drew
might.
No.
Thinking about it.
A ROM. I don't think he even has a burner.
No, he does. Because he paid like $300 for it.
Okay. Good lord. We're going to go back to PC cards for a moment. Because they are used to add more functionality to laptops. And memory. I know the micro drives used to be PC cards at one point. I used to have a lot of the IBM micro drive PC card drives. Okay.
And you can get solid state like PC cards as well. So you can get like, you know, 256 gig on a PC on an express card that goes into a slot.
You can also get adapters to plug, and I used one of these with my Plex Talk. A compact flash card, and you stick it into this thing, and then it becomes a PC card. And on the PTR1, that was the only way you could write to a compact flash card. The 2 now just has a compact flash card. Other things like modems and network cards can also be added using PC cards. There are three types of PC cards, which you have to do a worksheet on. Okay? They each have different thicknesses and allow you to add different components. New computers use the Express PC card slot. Express cards can either be 34 millimeters or 54 millimeters wide. A 34 millimeter card, a 30 millimeter mm card, millimeter card, is compatible with the 50 millimeter slot, which makes sense because it's narrow enough. But if you only have a 34 millimeter slot, obviously a 54 millimeter card will not fit. So check the specifications of your laptop to see which slot you have. Most of your information you'll need for the answering laptop expansion questions is in the figures for section 6.3.4. So take a look at those. They're pretty well described. They're pretty well described in there. Certainly better than if I were to go ahead and do this again, or if I were to go through it. So please look at those when you go to answer that worksheet. Looking at batteries again, modern laptop batteries can run from 2 to 10 hours. I'd like to see 10 hours. To maximize the running time of your laptop on batteries, it is important to configure your power management settings. Yeah.
Well, guess what, guys? I saw this thing the other day. What? It was the FitPC demo. It was this little tiny computer that's about the size of two packets of cigarettes, and it's got like a hard drive and stuff, and it's exceedingly low power, 1.6 gigatom, 512 mega RAM, solid-state storage.
Wow.
It ran, I kid you not, for 80 hours off a car battery. 80 hours.
That's
Wow.
So YouTube on FitPC-2, FitPC-2 runtime test on YouTube, and you'll see the video where it just stayed up for like almost a week. So if you want battery life, you want a FitPC, and you could probably run this thing off a few D cells for hours. And that sort of stuff.
Anyone remember you? Well, you wouldn't have to use the car battery, but yes, that would be a lot to carry.
Well, you wouldn't actually. No, you could just build. You could just build like a stack of AAAs into a battery box, or a double A's into a battery box with a FitPC. It'd be about the same size, and it would run for hours and hours and hours and hours and hours on them. But to be fair, you've got to understand that the battery life is inversely proportional to what the thing's doing. If you've got something like a Sense or whatever that only does one thing at a time, really, because it's not multitasking, it just switches between the two at once, it's sort of cooperative task switching, you will get 20 hours or 30 hours or whatever out of a battery. But to expect a full-blown netbook to give you 300 hours out of its little battery is unreasonable. It's got a lot going on in
there. No. It certainly does. To take advantage of some of these wonderful power management features, ACPI must be enabled in the BIOS. Usually it is enabled by default in laptops, but if you can borrow some eyes, it does pay to check. The BIOS controls things such as system states, battery and AC modes, thermal management, CPU, also PCI bus power management, wake on LAN or WOL. Note, WOL might require a cable connection inside the computer from the network adapter to the motherboard. If you do want to check the power settings in your BIOS, enter BIOS setup by pressing the appropriate key or key combination while the computer is booting. Typically this is the delete key or the F2 key, but there are several other options, so look at the motherboard or laptop manual. Locate and enter the power management settings menu item and use the appropriate keys to enable ACPI mode if it is not already enabled.
Big
save
hint.
And exit BIOS setup.
If you are installing and wish to upgrade to Windows 7, make sure that ACPI is enabled or bad things, TM, will happen. And it is very important that you go into the BIOS and check this before you try the upgrade so that it doesn't crash and burn horribly, as well as making sure that you have the latest BIOS before you go to Windows 7. We found out that the hard way on the EEPC 1000 HE. That is an hour of my life I will never get back.
Okay. These steps are only a guide, and as always, check your motherboard manufacturer or laptop manufacturer for the exact steps for your laptop. To configure ACPI power set. Oh, and by the way, we have a great recording on how BIOSes are how a particular BIOS is laid out. If you haven't, I'm sure you probably listened to it for your BIOS lab, unless you've got someone to help you with your own. But you could always refer back to that if you wish to. Now that hopefully ACPI is enabled, to configure the power settings in Windows, go to the Power Options, Applet, and Control Panel. These settings allow you to reduce power usage by individual components or the whole computer. You can customize the following: hard drive, display shut off, and display power down, shut down, hibernate, and suspend modes, Windows XP, shut down, hibernate, and sleep modes, and sleep modes are what Windows Vista and 7 call them. Low battery warnings. Just to be clear, Windows XP calls the suspend mode standby mode. The Vista and 7 call it sleep mode, and the Mac does as well. Power schemes, as they are called in Windows XP, and or power plans, as they're called in Windows Vista and 7, are a collection of hardware and system settings that manage the power usage of the computer. These power settings can help you save energy, maximize system performance, or achieve a balance between the two. Both the hard drive and the display consume large amounts of power. They can be configured under the Power Schemes tab in Windows XP and the Change Plan Settings link in Windows Vista and 7. You will notice default schemes are already in place. These were set up when you installed your OS. You can customize the time your computer is idle before it goes to sleep in this area. You can also customize how long the hard drive and display will stay active before they shut down, before they go to sleep. There are settings for each of these that apply when the AC adapter is used or when the battery is used. On a desktop, you'll only see one of each setting because generally you only are powering it from AC. Possibly if you're using a UPS, they might have their own settings as well. I've never actually done that. But on a laptop, you're going to have, you know, how turn off the display after, let's say, 10 minutes for the screen and the when you're on AC power, and 2 minutes when you're on battery power. So yes, you can have the display turn off after 5 minutes on AC, but only 1 minute on battery. Those are actually even probably better values than the example I just gave.
There's a problem with that, though. If you have it turning off after a minute and somebody sighted is reading the screen, obviously the screen will go blank when they're halfway down. They then have to unblank it and figure out where they're up to. So if you're blind, that's cool.
That is true.
If you're sighted, a minute may not give you enough time to read a full screen full of text, so perhaps being a little less aggressive with that would make you better friends, unless your sighted key person is going to continuously tap on your keyboard to keep the screen awake.
Yeah, that you could, if you knew that you were going to have somebody reading a lot, you could up it and then put it back down again when that doesn't happen. You can save your new power scheme
as well.
Yes. I actually had a tool on mine, a compact tool that would, you could set one brightness level on AC and another one on battery, and that was kind of cool.
Windows 7
by default. Some of that. Yeah, I imagine some of that's better in Windows 7, but I found that a cool idea.
It's 2011, people. If you have sufficient money, get a real computer and Windows 7, or a Mac if you're that way inclined, because there are lots of things that have changed since XP. XP is 2002 and really crusty.
It's time to retire it if you can.
And Vista is not cool.
No.
I'm working on it.
Fair enough.
Yeah, getting away from Vista or getting... Which are you working on?
Windows 7 runs under Boot Camp.
Oh yeah, it does.
I'm looking at 7.
Okay.
I gotta build
one. You can save your new power scheme or plan with a name of your choosing, and to keep the default schemes or plans intact. And you might wish to do that actually. If you do not want to completely shut down the laptop, you have two options in Windows XP: standby and hibernate. Standby is where documents and applications are saved in RAM, allowing the computer to power on quickly. This has been renamed to sleep in Vista and 7. Hibernate, documents and applications are saved to a temporary file on the hard drive and takes a little longer than standby to power on. In Windows Vista and 7, you have an additional option called hybrid sleep, where documents and applications are saved in RAM and data is written to the hard disk and takes a little longer than sleep to power on, but presumably not as long as Hibernate does. Is that kind of the idea there? I've never used it.
I'm sorry I wasn't paying attention because I'm trying to debug the cause of a TCP peer blah unexpectedly shrunk window, so I have no idea. Sorry.
Oh,
I don't think
hybrid
so.
Sleep takes a little bit longer than sleep to come on, but not quite as long as hibernate. Is that why they did that?
No. Hybrid sleep. Okay, hybrid sleep. I do know the answer to this one.
Good.
It basically saves the hibernation image to the hibernation partition, and it puts the machine into standby. So it does both. So it probably takes about another half second, or 1/2 second to 3 seconds, to go into hibernate slash standby thing. Basically, when you power it back on, it will attempt to resume from standby first. If the battery has gone flat and the standby image has been trashed, it then comes back off the hibernation partition on the hard drive, which is what, for example, happens under Linux with Tux on Ice and other suspend RAM, suspend disk power things that you can enable on Linux. It actually suspends to both, so it puts you in S3 and it saves out a hard disk image, so that if S3 chucks the spitsies because somebody ripped the power cord out, you will still come back to where you're up to. It does, however, cause problems on some machines. And Grace had a problem where, when she had hybrid sleep enabled,
with
SP1, but there may be newer drivers and stuff that will fix her up, because she doesn't have all the newer AMD drivers. So we might revisit that if we can be bothered.
Is that a separate option in called hybrid sleep in the menu, or do you have
it's
to
actually
what the function does?
It's hiding in the advanced power settings, and you can either turn it on or off. And if it is on, it will do both of them under Windows 7, and if it is off, it won't. And no, you cannot go hybrid sleep or hibernate. It's not like that.
Okay. All right. In Windows XP, you can adjust the low battery alarm. This option does not work in Windows Vista and 7 in the same way, I think. I mean, I've seen it give a alarm, but I'm not sure what they... Is it different in how it works in the two? So again, this is an area where I don't know, because I don't use Windows 7, so I apologize. I'm not exactly sure what's meant here. But you can, however, have the computer do a forced sleep, hibernate, or shutdown when the battery reaches a critical level, I guess, on those. Now we're going to go into the ACPI power states. You have a worksheet that has you matching these, and they're in your tests, so you'll want to know them. These are actual letter and number of things that aren't quite the same as just hibernate mode or suspend mode. These are more technical. S0. In S0, the computer is on and the CPU is running, which is probably what your computer is doing right now if you're plugged in and you're here in this lecture. S1, the CPU and RAM are still receiving power, but unused devices are powered down. In S2, the CPU is off, but the RAM is refreshed. The system is in a lower power mode than in S1. S3, the CPU is off, but the RAM is set to a slow refresh rate. This mode is often called save to RAM. In Windows XP, this state is known as suspend mode, or in Windows Vista and 7, it is sleep mode. In S4, the CPU and RAM are off. The contents of RAM have been saved to a temporary file on the hard disk. This mode is also called save to disk. In Windows XP, this is known as the hibernate mode. And this is also called hibernate in Vista and 7. And finally, in S5, the computer is off and nothing has been saved. Any questions on those?
Nope. There's often a BIOS setting that actually tells you whether S3 is going to be suspend to RAM or not, and whether USB devices can wake your system from S3, and what sort of things wake your machine from these power states. And if you forget to set this stuff properly, you will end up with a situation where the machine goes to sleep and you can't wake it up. So watch out. Well, it just happens, and you didn't bother going in to look, so you didn't change them, and it doesn't go. So watch out for that. Telling your machine that the mouse or the keyboard won't wake it up, and then putting it to sleep, and then belting keys on the on the keyboard and moving the mouse over your desk is not
good. And hoping that the power key will be your last resort for waking it up. The power button.
Maybe I did get that question right on that test. Who knows?
you might have.
Which question?
When replacing the power, I think he's talking about power states.
Yeah, it was whether a technician went to somebody that couldn't get their laptop started, what do? Bang on the keys or put the AC cord in and whatnot?
I suspect you did get that one. Okay, when replacing components in a laptop, it is especially important to get parts and use tools compatible with your laptop because they're all different, right? Remember that manufacturers use proprietary parts much more in laptops than in desktops, so you are more likely to purchase you're more likely to purchase components that won't work if you're not careful. Some components that may need replacement include AC adapter, battery, optical drive, hard drive, memory, and PC expansion cards. Many of these components are hot swappable, meaning that they can be inserted and removed while the computer is on. And we see our earlier caveats on hot swappable devices. If devices are non-hot swappable, such as RAM, find replacement instructions from the manufacturer. Let me repeat that again. RAM, not supposed to be hot swappable. I do know of one person who may have been, who was able to change RAM in a netbook while it was still on. I know of one person who did that. But you're really not supposed to do that. And you have to have a lot of knowledge
and experience
before you can even think about. No, it didn't. You can probably guess who that was, actually.
I think it would have needed to reboot,
already
though.
A couple times. No, one of the other instructors, not this past semester, but the one before, was saying that they were on Skype with someone, and their netbook got its RAM changed by Mr. Taylor, and it still went, I think is what the story was. I'll have to go back and look at that one.
No, that is physically impossible.
Maybe it was something
because
else.
It was a keyboard.
Oh, keyboard. Not RAM. Keyboard.
How can that happen?
RAM. It wouldn't.
But
there's no way the system would
stay up. That's still kind of scary.
She wasn't on the same computer.
She was.
She wasn't?
Yeah, and they hot plugged it, and it did actually survive. It was a potentially dangerous thing to do. However, because the keyboards in the netbooks are actually proprietary and don't actually do the PS2 thing, it is theoretically possible to do it. But if you
not
do
RAM,
it and
I
get too excited and break that flexi strip while you're messing with that, then that will be unpleasant times. But no, if you pull all the RAM out of a computer and change it, there's no possible way it could keep running because you've ripped the running image out of the computer. That's impossible.
Sorry about that, I totally broke that, guys. Fail on my part. Okay. So RAM is not hot swappable. Keyboard shouldn't be either. But find out from the manufacturer how you're supposed to replace the RAM. Follow all safety ESD guidelines, and what I just described certainly did not do that. Not what you want to do. Always turn off the computer, unplug the AC adapter, and remove the battery when inserting or removing devices that are not hot swappable. This is definitely testable. You will see this a bunch of times. In fact, when replacing just about all these components, unplug the computer, turn it off, and remove the battery. And if you're on a Mac, get Apple to do it for you because you ain't removing the battery. All AC adapters must be compatible with the manufacturer and model of laptop that you have. We don't want to have a fried laptop. That's not good. AC adapters are either auto-switching or fixed input. This is testable. So auto-switching power supplies our AC adapters can switch between 110 volts and 220 volts, while a fixed input AC adapter only operates under a specific voltage. Auto switching allows the power supply to be used in different countries.
How many people have we got in Australia? I think we've only got one. And Vanessa, www.zaz.com.au has a switch mode plug pack that goes from 3 to 12 volts with a USB charge capability, and it will charge iPods and stuff in double quick time. The reason I mentioned, And it goes from 110 to 220. I think it's actually all the way through. So if you've got like 150 or 160 volts, it'll still go. So the switch modes are actually a gradient most of the way through. Whereas the fixed input ones, if you plug a 110 volt fixed into a 240 volt outlet, bang, smoke.
Bang. I bet that's fun.
How do you tell? The weight of them. The switch modes are generally lighter, and if you want to be 100% sure, get somebody to read the rating plate.
In the module, you'll have some examples of how to replace laptop components, and I would like you to have a look at these, but remember that they can be different depending on your model of laptop. There's so much in here, I thought that that would be something that would be good for you guys to look up, because they get very, very detailed. Chapter 13, Advanced Laptops, will also talk a little bit more about which parts are supposed to be replaced by consumers as consumer replaceable units, and which are field replaceable that only technicians should be doing, or the manufacturer of the laptop should be doing, I guess.
Also, if you're messing with power supplies, eBay, talking multimeter, go find one. They're so worth having.
On some laptops, the PC card, optical drive, and USB devices are hot swappable. However, internal components, as we've discussed, such as hard drive, RAM, and battery, are not hot swappable. Remove a hot swappable device. Left-click the safely remove hardware icon in the Windows system tray to ensure that device is not in use. Left-click the device that you want to remove. A message pops up to tell you it is safe to remove the device. Remove the hot swappable device from the laptop. If you right-click safely remove hardware, you will have to deal with a dialog box rather than a simple menu. You'll have to actually go find the device and then hit stop, and then when it says you can, you hit OK, and it's just a few more steps. With JAWS, insert F11 sometimes works, and that if you do it that way, right-click is the default option, so if you just bang enter, you're not actually going to be left-clicking, so you have to actually make sure that you're doing the one you want. Interestingly, a lot of times when I do this, I'll get the power meter will pop up after I've removed a device with the safely removed hardware. I don't know why that is, but I just close it. And I tell people if the power meter comes up on it, especially on a desktop, I don't know why it comes up, but just close it. It's fine. Has anyone else ever seen that?
Yeah, I've seen it.
Yeah, it's a bit strange, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Laptops can access the internet and other devices in many ways, including Ethernet, wireless Ethernet, modem, Bluetooth, infrared, and cellular WAN. To use the Ethernet, plug the RJ45 cable into the computer. If the internet does not work right away, you will need to configure IP settings. These are likely on a test, so we will briefly go over the path, which we will cover in Module 8 in more detail. Also, this chapter gives you details in the notes, so if you want to have a better idea, please look in the notes if you want a general idea there. Wireless NICs can be built in or be added as external or express cards. My laptop has one of these external wireless cards. You can also get a USB one as well. IP information is configured in exactly the same way. You configure it on a Windows NIC. I didn't put this in here, which I should have, and I'm sorry about that. It is in your notes, though. Basically, what you're going to do is find your network card and look at the properties. In Windows 7, it's particularly important to choose change adapter settings, which seems a bit not quite so intuitive, but that's where it is. Have a look for that in your notes. There's just so much in here. The configuration of a modem, the steps to do that, because some of the laptops will have them too, is that, and actually you may only have dial-up where you're going, depending on if you're going to, you know, abroad, and that's the only method of internet connection you have. It's better than nothing for some stuff. So the steps you want to take if you're doing a modem is you want to make sure the modem is installed and turned on if an external modem is attached. Attach a phone cable from the wall outlet to the appropriate RJ11 modem port. Use the Install New Modem wizard to add the modem. In Windows XP, we're going to go Start, Control Panel, Phone and Modem Options, specify the dialing information for your location, and then click OK. And then there's going to be, and then we want the Add Hardware Wizard is going to start, and you're going to click Modems, Add, Next. The Add Hardware Wizard will install the device driver, and then you will click Finish. Vista, it's Start, Windows, Control Panel, Phone and Modem Options. You're going to, again, specify the dialing rules for your location and click OK. The Add Hardware Wizard will start. You're going to choose Modems and then Add. If prompted for permission, click Continue. Choose Next. Add Hardware Wizard. The Add Hardware Wizard will then let you go through and installs the device drivers. And then you click Finish when that's done. In 7, they want you to go Start Control Panel. They want you to search for Phone and Modem Options in the Search Control Panel box. Choose Phone and Modem and choose New to create a new location or Edit to modify an existing location. You're going to specify the dialing rules for your location and click OK. You're going to click the Modems tab, Add, and you're going to click Next. And then the Add Hardware Device Wizard is going to install the drivers and you're going to click Finish. You can use the phone, you can use the Phone and Modem Options tab to configure the following tabs to configure the following settings. Dialing rules. This is a list. You can add, edit, and delete dialing locations. I think in here you can also put things like whether you need to dial a number for an outside line and whether call waiting should be disabled and things like that. I think that's under dialing rules as well. Under the Modems tab, you can add or remove a device or view the properties of a device. The Advanced tab is a list you can add, remove, and configure telephony providers installed on the computer, and I don't quite know exactly what that is, but I've seen it before. Note, to configure an installed modem, open Phone and Modem Options in the Control Panel. On the Modems tab, click the modem you want to configure, and then click Properties. Any questions? Actually, we've only got about 5 more minutes left. Doesn't it though?
Guess what, people?
And we've done this. If you think it's the old days, think again, because if you don't have an iPhone or you don't have a data plan, we actually use iBluver, which is a jailbreak app that allows you to use your mobile phone's Bluetooth modem for connectivity, which chews less battery than using JoyQ Spot or Walking Hotspot. And in fact, Grace uses it with her Braille Sense to log onto the net to look up karaoke lyrics through her mobile phone rather than actually messing with Wi-Fi, which chews a lot more bandwidth and power and stuff. So you might think it's all years ago, but hey, it's still alive and well, and your old 6600 phone can be used as a dial-up wireless modem. And you can actually do it without PC Suite if you do it by hand. If you actually put the int files in, you can avoid PC Suite entirely. And on netbooks, that's highly advisable.
Which is a good thing to do.
Wow.
But do they still take AT commands?
Yes, they do. And in fact, there is a document on Nokia's website where you can actually get a list of the AT commands that the modem will take. And yes, I have them. And yes, they work under Linux. And yes, there are utilities to send and receive text messages from the command line under Linux. Server monitoring, anyone?
Wow. Okay, we're going to quickly talk about Bluetooth and get through this as much as we can. God, there is a lot of stuff in this chapter.
Yeah, there's a lot.
Yeah, this is going to have to definitely be a part 3. Bluetooth. It says here that Windows activates Bluetooth by default. To turn it off or on, look for a switch on the laptop, an FN key combination, or an area on a touch strip if one exists.
That's not always true.
I'm not actually sure.
In fact,
yeah,
a lot of notebooks, until you actually install the Bluetooth drivers, the actual Bluetooth is invisible, and then there's one piece of software that you install, and it goes da-dink, 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 and about 10 Bluetooth devices come up, and the whole thing wakes up and goes. So, not always the case. But before you even get started, look for a switch to make sure that the switch is on. Because, believe me, you can spend 2 hours battling with drivers to find that the switch is off.
Yeah, if you've got physical switches, make sure you know what they do. Make sure you know which position is on, which position is off. And some of these are spring-loaded, so be careful. Bluetooth should be enabled in the BIOS if it isn't already, but it likely will be. But you can also check if this isn't working and you know the computer has Bluetooth and you've tried everything else. You might try doing this. Ensure the device that you wish to use is switched on and in discovery or discoverable mode. Check the manual or other documentation.
Get an AM radio. Stick it near your Bluetooth device. And if it is in discovery mode, you'll hear pfft. And that tells you that it's in discovery mode. No, it actually ticks once a second as it sends out the broadcast packets.
Oh, okay.
And with our little eBay Bluetooth keyboards, that's how we can tell when they're on and in discovery mode without looking at the lights.
Now, it might not be a bad idea to get a little AM radio and put it in your backpack. I've actually bought one for $30 or $40 that actually is also a weather band, and it has digital, and it was a Sony, and it had a lot of buttons, and I thought, oh, God, I won't be able to use this. But it's fantastic! Anyway, check the manual or other documentation that came with the device for details on how discovery mode is accomplished. The Bluetooth wizard should be used to find and connect with discoverable devices in range of your computer. Let's see. The paths in Windows XP start greater than control panel, greater than Bluetooth devices, greater than device, and then add Bluetooth device. Wizard will start. You're going to choose My Devices Setup and Ready to be Found, and then choose Next. Select the discovered device when it appears. Choose Next. If prompted, enter a passkey. Choose Next and Finish. Your passkey, if it's not user-settable on the device, should be also provided in the documentation. For Windows Vista, we're going to do Start, Control Panel, Network, and Internet. Set up a Bluetooth device, a Bluetooth-enabled device, which is probably a link. I'm going to choose Device, Add, and if prompted, click Continue. We're going to add Bluetooth device wizard will start. You're going to choose My Device is Set Up and Ready to be Found. Click Next. Select the discovered device in the list. Choose Next. If prompted, enter a passkey and choose Finish. Windows 7 changes things slightly. You're going to go Start, Control Panel, Add a Device. Select the discovered device and click Next. Enter the pairing code provided by Windows 7 into the Bluetooth device, if possible. When the device has been successfully added, click Close. You do get a chance to enter a fixed passkey, in other words, a passkey that is preset for you in this dialog box, but it's not how they do it in default. In addition to the wizard, you have tabs you can use to configure a device that has already been set up.
The device this is Apple adds, does this too.
Yes, stupid, Apple does too, and
stupid.
I was annoyed.
It generates these stupid passcodes. I think it's actually a change in the standard.
And what annoys me is that VoiceOver puts each digit of the code in a separate element. So you have to keep going right arrow, right arrow, right arrow, right arrow, seven, you know, seven, right arrow, three, right arrow, four, right arrow, two. No!
Can't you so just go flick down and it fixed. Reads it?
I'm talking about
That's
on the
what
Mac.
I do.
It's quite
oh,
annoying.
Okay.
Yeah, I I suppose on the iPod you could have it read it to you.
You can, I've done it. That's how I do it. I just flick down and it goes 4175 and I go 41. But then it actually causes problems when you can't actually put the key that it generates into the device, and I haven't figured a way of overriding that on the iPods because I don't think you can.
Yeah, I'm not. I think you can. Maybe you can't. I know for a Braille display you're just asked for it because most of the Braille displays don't let you. Shall we quickly go through the tabs in the Bluetooth box, even though we're a little bit over? Do
can't
people
we just
mind?
Read the notes?
Or yeah, you can go ahead and do that if you want.
No, I'm serious, because I mean, like, we can go through every tab easy. And stuff, but how many people are going to remember Start, Control Panel, Bluetooth, whatever, 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 whatever? It's gone.
Yeah, pretty much. So they tell you what the different tabs can do. So we'll start with infrared next time. How's that sound?
If you have any questions on the tabs, bring them to the next lecture, seriously.
Yeah, if you do.
The other thing I was going to say
All right,
is
thank you.
If you have VMware Workstation 7, You can actually make yourself a Windows 7 virtual machine that will be good for 30 days, 120 days if you rearm it. We might talk about that at some point if you guys want to play with Windows 7 but are a bit scared. You can do it without busting your machine.
Alright, thank you guys so much for coming and participating so much. It's been great. So next week we'll pick up on Infrared and have part 3. Sorry,
and
there's
tomorrow is
so much crud in here. Yes,
thank you guys,
that sounds fantastic. Thank you, guys.
Should be lots of fun.
All right, I'm going to hit stop unless anyone has any other pending questions on the course.
I was going to say something.
Grace is
going to
say something.
Okay.
We know we're taking a while on these. Rest assured, we will get through it, but we like all of the interaction and everybody being able to ask questions and talk about.
Absolutely. That's one of the most valuable parts of these lectures, and that's the reason I showed up almost every single time I could when I took the class, also because I have no life. So that's the other reason.
The other thing that actually happened is when we first did these courses, it was basically a read-through of the notes and there was very little interaction, and it's much harder as an instructor to teach that way. And it's really boring and I really...
Unless you're really into...
Yeah, and if you are, try the other set of lectures, honestly. But if you're not, we're happy to have you, and we're happy to have your input. So, you know, there are shorter lectures available if you would prefer them.
If you want to tell us about, you know, feedback with the lectures, you know, let us know individually if you prefer us to do something differently, or we're certainly open to that feedback. But do let us know individually for our class if there's things you want changed.
We will always listen. We may not take your advice on board, but we will always listen. We can guarantee that much, and we try to take as much advice on board as possible, and we do try to do things about it, but we will always promise to listen to any suggestions that you have on the lectures.
And we will always explain why not if we don't do something.